It's time to talk about the outdoors in South Alabama. Hunting, fishing, and getting outside along the Great Gulf Coast. It's time to take it outside with FM Talk 106.5 Outdoors. With reports, stories, how-to information, and Dr. Bill's Marine Forecast. Here's Sean Sullivan and Mike Ward.
And away we go, FM Talk 106.5 Outdoors. Good to see my partner, my buddy, Captain Mike Ward. Oh, wait, I don't have your mic on. Hold on. You're on a different mic than normal. There you go.
There you go. All right. Good to be back here from the boat show, man. Had a great time at the boat show this weekend.
Yeah.
We had some of our fishermen that couldn't show up. They were sick or they were had a charter or several other excuses.
You want to call them out by name? Is that what you want?
It's Sean.
But it's not Sean. No, Sean was that was not not an excuse there, that's for sure. But, yeah, it was good to see everybody at the boat show.
It was. It was a good boat show, too. I believe they – I mean, I think it was a little bit better than last year. I know Friday was a little better, and I think Saturday and Sunday looked like it was a little bit better. So, anyway, it was a good boat show, no matter what.
You know, it is a thing that happens here, too, at least on this show. I don't know in everybody else's world, but, you know, we stay in deer hunting mode, duck hunting mode on the show, you know, and fishing.
Yep.
And then a thing happens. Now, the boat show moves, depending on the calendar. But post-boat show, we still talk fishing, but we start talking turkey hunting.
We do.
I mean, it's that thing. So he didn't know about that rule, but he's great to come on with us and talk some turkey with us. He's not only done this as a job, he's written now the books. And joining us, Steve Barnett, thanks for coming in.
Glad to be here.
Yeah, let's talk about your history to get because I think about it, you got a new book out. I've got your previous book as well, The Wild Turkey in Alabama.
Yes,
which I love. New book out. We're going to talk about. But how'd you get here? Like, how'd you end up in the world of writing books about turkeys?
Well, it seemed to be a good fit when I was with the department before I retired.
Right.
You know, we really
because the first book you were still with the department, weren't you?
That's correct. Okay. That was published in 2008.
Okay.
My wife and I co-authored that book. But I thought we needed a book about, you know, the first book was history of the wild turkey, some research and restoration, and habitat management, harvest. We really didn't have that anything, you know, contemporary with the department. So I thought, you know, this would be a good thing for me to take on. So
yeah, and I think in your time with the department and then writing the book, too, the story of wild turkeys, and we say around the country, but let's focus in Alabama, it is changing. It is not a static one. I mean, I think about, we talk about it on the show, and we talk about the biological reasons and all that, but from where we were in the 90s, when, you know, I really on my own first started turkey hunting, I had been carried some in the 80s, but in the 90s, where I didn't realize how good it was till later, it was fantastic.
It was, yeah.
And then it carried on for a while, and obviously, as biologists will tell me, everything's site-dependent, and but we had a trailing off of those numbers. I mean, just not just in anecdotal experiences from hunters, but the science showed that we weren't making as many turkeys in Alabama as we had in the past.
Once we started conducting our annual brood survey to sort of measure reproduction, successful hens, nesting, count the number of poults per hen, you know, when we started doing that statewide, you know, over several years, we were seeing a trend, and it was – and it's still averaging, you know, about two poults per hen, and sometimes a little bit less than two poults per hen.
Yeah, and give us that number. What's neutral, what's forward, what's reverse? To put it, you know, what number, like poults per hen is two neutral, or two, what's building, what's
two is questionable on sustainability.
Okay.
You can probably maintain a turkey population, but there's still a lot of uncertainty exists on growing a turkey population. It's going to be difficult to grow. If you're especially less than two poults per hen, and for several years in Alabama, we have been less than two poults per hen over average. Now, with the brood survey, it's a statewide survey, but we still need more participants in the survey to really better reflect what's going on statewide, because sometimes, some places, there's pockets, like our staff on assigned to wildlife management areas. You may have certain areas where it gets reported better than on private lands. We do have a lot of private land partners, but we still need more to help the survey, increase the sample number.
Yeah, just get more information into the system. And, you know, I know in the old days, too, thinking about how the state used a mailman, you know, mail routes to talk about, you know, how many turkeys they saw. My new thing to throw into the mix here, here's the 2026. The number of dang deliveries for Amazon, whoever's the mailman can still be in it, but let's get the Amazon delivery drivers in the country. They're going to be, they're on those roadways more than anybody else out there. So,
but it's also important for folks who are participants recognize what turkeys look like, what a hen looks like, what a gobbler looks like, and what poults look like, and poults, their, you know, plumage and their appearance changes over time as they age. And, you know, so far the department has limited the participants to, I mean, there's a few private partners, but it's mostly state agency folks. But
right.
they're, I think they're looking now at a, you know, in the future of a public, more public participating in that to get the numbers up.
I love it. More eyes on the ground. Yeah. I mean, just like, you know, so many surveys we do. I mean, turkey hunters are the most engaged in making sure we got turkeys.
Yes.
Yeah, you know, we're going to volunteer to do it.
And we have cameras. All of us have tons of cameras.
Right.
You know, so I would think putting the cameras out and getting surveys with the hens and the poults.
Well, we do have, we have a protocol for using cameras with our staff. But for this specific survey, it's observations, what you eyeball from usually your vehicle on roadsides or wildlife openings or wherever you see turkeys. So it's an observational survey rather than a trail camera survey.
Yeah.
So, and what I'm thinking about, too, is from the first book, Wild Turkey in Alabama, you said 08. And, and you did have a portion of it. I've read it many times about habitat management. But now we're going to talk about the new book, and that, it does make sense to me because growing up hunting in the 90s, you know, starting 88, 89 in there, I honestly didn't, I mean, I thought about places that had turkeys, you know, and I'd go, well, there's turkeys going to be down this bottom this time of year, and then they're going to be up, you know, near a burn this time of year. But I didn't really think about why. But it took, I think, this decline in turkey population for, I mean, you'd ask me at 20 years old what brood rearing habitat was. I had no idea. Like, I guess where they rear broods, I don't know what it looks like, or what, you know, nesting and why. All that stuff, I think people become way more interested in it because of this decline or the static nature of turkey numbers.
Yep. Landowners are much more educated now about the needs of a lot of wildlife, including wild turkeys, and what, like you mentioned, Sean, brood habitat, what that actually looks like. And I think the new book, you know, the intent with the book was to keep the chapters' narratives concise, not too wordy, but have a lot of photos with very detailed captions.
Yeah.
So that was the intent to
Well, the photos are great because when you say something, you get in a chapter, and you're saying, let's say you're saying brooding habitat, you're going to show me what that looks like.
Absolutely.
Right.
Yep.
You know, and it's – and what – and we'll come right back to – we come back into the chapters of the book. But I do wonder, were we without – doing it on purpose, was land being managed differently in that 90s, that decade, going into the 2000s, that gave these turkeys better, you know, nesting cover, brood rearing cover, anything like then by mistake were we doing it, and did we lose that, and that's what we're trying to bring back, or was it something else?
In some cases, there was an increase in prescribed fire, and with landowners, you know, managing their land for wildlife and for deer, for turkeys, so that was part of it. And in some cases, landowners were doing those kind of things, but still didn't get a positive response.
Mm-hmm.
One thing about wildlife populations, there are no absolutes. There's sometimes things that happen that you just, we can't, that scientists can't explain.
Well, every biologist I know, y'all just say, well, it depends.
there's a lot of factors, and yeah, you have to get down in the weeds.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, and speaking of which, some weeds are very, very good.
Some weeds are very good, as described in the book.
Yeah, so, and what I want to talk about here, we'll go through this book and talk about where people can pick it up. We've got a couple minutes for the news break here. But Wild Turkey Habitat Management in Alabama, that's the new book.
Yep.
And so you're going to take us through it, looking through it, not just manage, but you also get narrow enough to what ecoregion we're talking about, because somebody in up north Alabama in the mountains versus somebody in the river swamp, somebody in the pine woods. Like.
Yeah, for several years, I had this idea that, I mean, there's a lot of good information already out there available for landowners and improving habitat for wild turkeys. And I'll repeat some of that stuff, but I wanted to come at it from the angle of ecoregion that are ecological, geographical, distinct areas based on soil types, terrain features, plants and animals. And thankfully, all these ecoregions have wild turkeys.
Mm-hmm.
That's number one. So that was sort of the angle to look at it from that aspect.
Yeah, because, I mean, while they're, I don't know, I mean, maybe, I don't know, you could tell me how adaptable you think they are. You think white-tailed deer can live in, dang, you could pick the habitat they can live in. Wild turkeys can live in more than one habitat. I mean, some people have never hunted them in anything but a river swamp, and somebody's never hunted them anything but up on the side of a mountain up in northeast Alabama, and somebody's never hunted them anywhere other than row-planted pines, and, you know.
And I think there's a misconception sometimes when you're talking about deer management and turkey management or habitat management. You know, deer can thrive in thickets.
Yeah.
Turkeys do not. If you manage for gopher tortoises down here,
mm-hmm.
you can have a lot of turkeys, you know, burning in open areas,
right?
Savannas, woodland savannas, mast trees. So it's really a matter of vertical management from the forbs and grasses on the ground vertically to the shrubs to your trees or mast producers to have good habitat.
Okay, we come back. We're going to get more of that in detail. Our guest and his new book, it's Steve Burnett, his new book, Wild Turkey Habitat Management in Alabama, an ecoregion guide for landowners. Great stuff, and we continue the conversation next. Welcome back. FM Talk 106.5 Outdoors. Sean Sullivan, Mike Ward. Glad to have you all along. Remember to check us out over at facebook.com/FM Talk 106.5 Outdoors. And great to get this man in. Wild Turkey Habitat Management in Alabama, an ecoregion guide for landowners. Stephen Barnett, or as I call him, Steve Barnett. I've always said Steve, you know, but on a book title, you got to be Stephen, but I'll call you Steve. Wild Turkey in Alabama. I mean, I love that book. Been reading it for, well, since 08. But you did talk about habitat management in that book, but it was not the whole book.
Yeah, this book, the new book, focuses strictly on habitat management.
Which is, I mean, it's just a thing. I mean, if you're into turkeys, you're all about some habitat management, because something changed and those didn't even have to think about it. Turkey numbers went away and people are trying to do everything they can to hold on to what they have or bring it back.
I mean, without a doubt, there has been, you know, the data suggests there's been a decline, and it's not restricted to just Alabama. It's across the
right.
Southeast.
Right. Yeah, I was going to say the rest of the country. People talk about it, you know. That, but it's interesting. I want you to, the timing of it. This may just be conspiracy stuff or just spurious correlations, but it was some period of time. Somebody was saying from reintroduction to the population rising to it leveling off and then trailing off. They were saying, like, hey, look at this state. It happened 10 years before, but they stocked 10 years before, something like that. Have you heard that?
Not exactly, but we've been, actually, the brood survey I mentioned, the statewide survey, and I believe it started in 2010. We were doing a survey in southwest Alabama in this region since the 80s, and the reason we were doing that is because most of the turkeys that the state moved to release as part of the restoration came from the Fred T. Stimson and Upper State Sanctuaries, which mm-hmm. are now special opportunity areas. So before we moved turkeys back then, staff had to go out and do the brood survey to see how successful hens were before they would, you know, that determined how many turkeys would be moved.
Yeah, before we brought out the rocket nets and figured out how many you take. Yeah.
But when I went back and looked at that data, and I tried to put it on a line graph, and this was during restoration. We were still moving turkeys. I think I was able to find data from 1990, and then fast forward to now. There was a slow decline even then.
Really?
For southwest Alabama. This is just
okay.
This region, but it was very slow, And until our staff looked at that, and then other states were, some states already had very long data sets from many years ago. Then we looked at that regional one and then started our statewide, which was showing the same thing. So it's been going on
quite some time.
So our neighboring states are having the same issues, say
yes.
Georgia,
yes.
Florida.
Yep.
And Mississippi's had it. Yeah, they've had their issues as well. So, I mean, we could take this. There's state of Alabama and so many southern states. There's only so much public land where – and listen, I keep up. It's so cool to see – what management areas are could prescribe fire on. You know, it's cool to watch that they're doing that to work on habitat. But there's only that's only so much of the state. We got majority of the states in private hands. So folks got to do something on their place to make a difference.
And that's important. You know, the folks who are going to gravitate to this book, they're going to have an interest in habitat management on their properties. Mm-hmm. Or they probably already have other resources that they've been reviewing and looking at, and they may want to add this to their arsenal. But some folks, you know, and I've seen a lot of properties across the state, especially down in southwest Alabama where I worked on my career, that there's some places that are just very thick. They're, like I mentioned before, deer woods.
Mm-hmm.
You know, deer can thrive in thickets. Turkeys do not. And some folks just, they may be apathetic to wildlife needs. It's not, they don't have an interest in it. They don't know what resources are available to improve things, and they can, if they can, reach out to the State of Alabama Division of Wildlife Freshwater Fisheries, NRCS, Farm Bill programs, and they can get cost assistance potentially to improve, you know, conditions.
One of the problems you have though is that most people are leasing property.
Yeah.
And they have to rely on what the landowner will do.
Absolutely.
You know, and they can ask the landowner if they would mind burning, but most of them don't want to do it. They're just afraid of fire. You know?
In those situations, they really don't have any means to manage the habitat. So they can manage wildlife openings. I recommend, and I've mentioned in the book, a good mix of clover for your, you know, most of your clover, the best growth is in spring and summer.
Got that right.
When hens have their young, their poults. So I would focus on plantings, supplemental plantings. But what makes or breaks turkey numbers is the habitat, the overall habitat, the total landscape. And those folks that are leasing in hunting clubs, they're very restricted.
Right.
And in those cases, it may be more important to implement a predator, fur bearer management program.
That's the interesting thing, and it depends, because exactly right, what your limitations are. Like trapping comes up, and we talk about trapping on the show, and mesopredators, and I mean you have Lord knows we do whole shows, put videos up and running DPs, you know, and what you can do with that. But also, that does take a long time.
It does. I mean, you can't let up.
It is. I mean, it's work. I mean, you go run trap line, you know, you plan for 90 minutes out of your day running trap line, whether you split it between morning, afternoon, or whatever. Okay. People have talked to me before, if you're lucky enough to have land you can do something on, they said it's not bad. Trapping's not bad. But if you took those hours and did, if you strip disc in the wintertime or did a controlled burn or did something like that, those hours may make more turkeys than just the trapping. So your opinion on that?
I agree. I think if a landowner has the means to manage the habitat, they own the property, then the priority should be habitat.
If you could do all of them, that's cool.
If you could do all of them, I would focus on habitat management. I'd spend most of my money on habitat management, and then I would go from there and see how things respond, the turkey numbers, and then secondarily, fur bearer management, if that's needed. It may not be needed if
you're right. I mean, if you do habitat management right, but I've got an idea that they're not just because people don't trap coons and all that anymore, but the amount of corn out, the coons are living. I mean, there's some fat coons and fat coons have bunch of offspring. I think it may be worse than it ever was. You might have to trap heavier than before because of people, with the corn. Any science to that?
Well, it's not. There's a lot of observations based on that. But it's not just
a well-fed mama coon can have more.
And it's not necessarily from fur bear trapping. It's people that are just feeding wildlife.
Mm-hmm.
You know, some folks are feeding year-round, And if you have a feeder set up, especially in the spring when hens are, they're initiating nests and they start incubating their clutches, and there's a feeder in the area, and it's like you're setting up an ambush point to some extent, potentially.
Yep.
So I definitely do not recommend those situations on feed on the ground
right
during nesting and brood rearing.
Yeah, the beauty for me has been running trap lines before turkey season. You got feed out there. One thing it can do for you is it can concentrate. You can get big catch numbers. You know, instead of, I used to run trap lines. Now often I'll run trap circles around, you know, around setups and through February work them over. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're still coming to a feeder and the coons, and you take X number of coons out there and you're like, I got them all. Wait 2 days to reset those DPs, and there's, I don't know where they came from, but there's more.
Yeah.
You know, you can get a knock them in the head.
Sometimes that's the response from, fur bearers, that the more you try to take them out, the more they respond and reproduce more. So that's why I want to focus where it's possible to focus on habitat management.
So let's talk about that on habitat. If you got it, we're talking about the triage list. Okay. You come to a property. Do I need focus more on nest and cover or brood and cover? Which one of those two is missing on the majority of tracks you would look at?
I would say brood rearing habitat.
Because you hear people say, I got the nesting cover.
You know, in each chapter of this book, and folks who actually read it, hopefully a lot of folks will, they're going to see that I focus on prairie situations, forbs and grasses, woodland savannas. If you have woodland savannas, you can provide year-round needs for wild turkeys. Like I mentioned before, if you got vertical management, your grasses and your forbs at the ground for brood rearing, you got shrubs and trees that are mass producers. I'm a firm believer in managing for oaks and other hard and soft mass species.
Now, people think about oaks. Let's talk about which ones we're going to manage for, because as much as I love to bow hunt over a swamp chestnut, is one of my favorite things to do. That's a heck of a big acorn for a turkey to eat in the fall.
Yeah.
So what are they eating? Like if you had to pick out, give me your all-star list of a hard mast. What are you going with?
I think white oak, water oak, live oak, overcup oak. I mean, it just depends on the site, you know, what the trees are suited to, whether it's
river swamp,
versus upland piney woods,
right? So with it depends on where you are. But I'm saying like the size, like if you could say, I mean, is a red oak, you know, people cuss a red oak, but you said water oak, people cuss a water oak, but you said they're used by turkeys.
They are, I think, a landowner who's managing their timber on their property, you know, I think they want to focus on the white oak family, like white oak, post oak, swamp chestnut oak, on those species. But you want to have a good mix at your stand. If you have a mass failure of one species, you want to have others that are going to produce, and you're more likely to have that in a good mix.
Don't put all your eggs in one basket.
That's right.
All right, coming right back, more with Steve Barnett. The new book, Wild Turkey Habitat Management in Alabama, an Eco-Region Guide for Landowners. Welcome back. FM Talk 106.5 Outdoors. Sean Sullivan, Mike Ward, and our guest Steve Barnett. Wild Turkey Habitat Management in Alabama. The new book out, and I think folks are going to pick this one up and go with it. Also, while you did the writing here, but you had some help in putting this book out, too.
Yeah, there's quite a few folks who I shared the manuscript with to review it, try to help me capture. You know, I wanted to capture the nuances or major differences in each ecoregion, so I wanted help with that. Plus, you always want folks to review to catch, you know, grammatical stuff, that kind of thing. So I had quite a few folks with the agency, and professional contractors who are also wildlife biologists that reviewed it.
And you had, I know, grants making this happen as well through, Alabama Wildlife? And
absolutely. Yeah. This book, you know, when I took this on, I never did want to try to sell it. I was hoping that I could get grants to pay for it.
Mm-hmm.
So I got the folks who I partnered with that funded the book was the Alabama chapter of the National Wild Turkey Federation, the Alabama Wildlife Federation. They funded the publication. But I got significant support from the Alabama Division of Wildlife and Freshwater Fisheries with the photos that are in the book.
One thing I love about this book, because every page has got a picture on it.
Where you can see, well, and it's good if you talk about habitat management technique. I can read about it, but seeing it, what does it look like? What do you know, we talk about brood rearing habitat. Okay, you can write about it and in Forbes and stuff like that, but then I can see a picture. I go, okay, now I know what it needs to look like.
Yeah, I think without a photo or photos that show what you're talking about, it's just difficult. I mean, it's difficult for a biologist to really examine that without photos to look at. And, you know, and some of the recommendations are somewhat generalized in each one of these applications in each ecoregion. And that's why I mentioned towards the end of the book, as far as landowner assistance, it's very important to reach out to natural resource professionals, wildlife biologists who are familiar with wild turkeys and wild turkey habitat management, to go to the next step and have site visits, to actually have someone come out there, because there, you know, within each ecoregion there can be very subtle or dramatic differences in stand composition and history of the property and how it's been managed. So it's important to have someone on the ground providing those recommendations.
Yeah, and y'all are always good to be able to point people, like you said in the beginning of the show, to resources to help them do that.
Absolutely. I think it's very important that, you know, landowners work with wildlife freshwater fisheries, wildlife biologists, NRCS, work with those folks, and they can point you to farm bill programs that may offer cost assistance.
Where do you see us here? This is another one of my easy questions. Glass half full, glass half empty in our efforts now for habitat in the state. Is there a Manhattan Project going on? Are we just staying still? Or
I stay with the glass half full.
Okay.
And I think we are making great strides. Landowners are more familiar with the needs of wild turkeys and habitat management if they have the means to do it. A lot more folks are doing that now. I think I saw a recent aerial image that I think was shared on Facebook of like
the number of fires.
Number of fires and smoke that you could see.
I think I was one of them.
And that was a good, you know, that was a good thing to see, with prescribed fire.
Yeah, it is. I mean, there are other tools, and we can talk about that if somebody's in a place where they can't. But dollar for acre, it's a pretty cost-effective way to manage habitat. Yeah, and also you mentioned it, and we'll go to like brood habitat, because I keep coming back to that, because that's the thing that is missing on a lot of places. But you talk about grasses and forbs. A lot of people, the grasses thing will come usually. You have a burn, you have enough sun, get there, you're going to get, you know, grasses, little blue stem, whatever, you know, a bunch of different grasses. The forbs thing is also maybe not as easy. I don't know, from a biologist's perspective, I mean, I've worked at it and I've had decent forb response, but not what I want, you know? I mean, I even slap leather for partridge peas. My grandfather would come down from heaven and whip my butt for putting them on purpose on a piece of ground, but I guarantee you I have.
You can get different responses depending on time of year that you burn or you put a disc down in the dirt. Fall versus spring disking, winter or dormant versus growing season burns. Each can have different plant responses in terms of grasses and forbs. So if you can do, you know, depending on the needs of the timber and what type of fire is needed, you can focus on. And that's why I say a site visit by a resource professional, they can tell you exactly what you need to do to get more forbs on your property, just broadleaf plants.
Yeah, and don't you think that's a bigger challenge? I mean, what do you see? I know you're at a lot of different places, but to me it seems like the heavier lift is forbs versus grasses.
Yeah, it's not. It's really just a mix. you know.
Right, what I'm saying is like the one that is more, for me, has been more of a challenge. Like the grass response is easier for me than Forbes.
I think sometimes, have you tried fall disking?
Other than in the food plots, no. I do winter
disking.
Well,
just fall disking and allowing that to
see
what
comes
back
in the spring. I always thought, so am I better doing that in the fall than the winter?
I think you should try to, you know, to experiment with some fall disking.
Okay.
To get some Forbes response.
So that does better for Forbes than the winter disk? Okay, good.
And you're not.
But I will say there's no absolutes again.
Of course.
Sometimes
of course.
It doesn't.
And that's something people can do. We talked about while fire is the most cost-effective per acre. If somebody can't burn or doesn't feel like burning, you can accomplish some of this with, I mean, herbicide applications, people do it, but also a disk.
Yeah, I think, and I mentioned this as far as wildlife openings in each ecoregion, it doesn't have to be your typical site-specific food plot or opening. Mm-hmm. If I had to choose on what type of wildlife opening to establish and maintain,
yes,
it would be a road. I would widen the road to 30 to 60 feet if I could and do some strip disking and alternate that maybe with some warm and cool season plantings, maybe a proso and brown top millet mix in the spring, a good clover mix in the fall. But I would focus on disking and allowing the native plants, the grasses and forbs, to come back, because that's where your brood habitat's going to be, especially in situations where you can't manage the woodlands. If you can manage your roads or roadsides,
mm-hmm.
But if you can widen the roads, that's even better. Also, it provides income for the landowners if they take timber off their roadsides to widen. You're providing, you know, they're getting income from their timber harvest in addition to any other cutting that they do on their property.
Just
not only that, when you widen your road up, it's better. You get more sunlight.
You're getting
on
more
your
sunlight.
So when you do have wet years, it's not it'll dry a lot quicker.
That's right.
Your roads won't be all messed up, ruts in it, and everything. So yeah, if you can widen your roads, it's really good.
And you get a better response from the plants that are coming back after you disc,
yep.
with that sunlight,
right,
100%,
and things that you may plant.
A pro tip here, when you have that cut, make sure you can ask those loggers, say, listen, y'all, the ones y'all cut right there on the roadside, try to cut them as low as possible, because rolling a disc over them, as a man who does this, you're like, I think there's a stump. Yeah, there's one right there. Slow down.
Yeah.
But they're, you would say even as a wildlife opening, if you choose a big field full of this stuff versus a roadside first.
I would choose roadsides first, but if I have an opportunity, I would do both. I would have a site-specific wildlife opening. You know, I would recommend at least an acre for that. Bigger is better.
Mm-hmm.
But I would still focus on roadsides, what we call linear openings, because they're meandering effect. They're snaking their way through the property, covering different types of habitat. They provide travel corridors. And typically, hens that hatch out a clutch of eggs, I mean, they're usually close to some type of opening.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of times it's a road, and she'll take her poats directly from the nest site to an opening. And a road is a good place to be if there's sufficient cover from grasses and forbs. It provides overhead protection for the poats and enough vertical that the hen is concealed to some extent too. But not so thick
that she can't see over either.
That she can't see over it, and not so thick that the poults can't move. And there's some photos in the book that show from I had to get down. I almost had to lay down on the ground to get a poult's perspective of the kind of stuff that they can move through. And I think in that case it was just panic grass. A timber company had done a fifth row thinning. And the panic grass just responded like crazy with all that sunlight that was provided. And it provided and that's where I took the picture. And, that's kind of the kind of cover that poults need. Not too thick. Structure, cover, to help them elude predators.
Yeah.
But they can move through it.
Yeah.
Escape cover.
Well, I've always, thought about, I work on quail cover. And I always do try to push a ping pong ball with your finger through something and see if a poult could make it. I just pictured it for a human being the way it is. If you're in a bottomland hardwood forest, right, it's summertime, leaves are everywhere, you're overhead protected. The sun isn't getting to you. You know, we don't have things trying to eat us, but your son's off you, but you can still go through it. Like, you can get a mini version of that for those quail chicks I already thought about, that they can, their feet are touching dirt,
yeah,
even though there's a stem of a forb here and a grass there, and they can kind of network around it.
And if it's too thick for poults to move through, then they're going to be more susceptible to getting caught by something.
Yep.
You know, when they're about 10 days old, they can actually fly to get off the ground, and their survivability goes way up.
Yeah, isn't that a huge thing the second they can get
up? It's a huge thing, yeah, because they can, you know, let's say, for instance, a coyote comes in and sort of busts the,
right,
the brood up. They can fly up and get on lower limbs until, you know, things are good to
rally back up. All right, yeah, coming right back. Boris C. Barnett, new book is Wild Turkey Habitat Management in Alabama. Welcome back. FM Talk 106.5 Outdoors. Glad to have you all along. My partner, Captain Mike Ward. And good to see Steve Barnett. Brand new book, Wild Turkey Habitat Management in Alabama, an eco-region guide for landowners. We've been talking about it, but Steve, I better ask you, like, where can somebody... I got my copy right here because you came to the studio. But where does somebody get this? You got an online thing, too. You sent me that already.
I did. Yeah. There is an online... there's a digital copy that anyone can use. The hard copies, it's sort of a limited edition as far as the number that were printed. But the Alabama chapter, National Turkey Federation, they have some. Alabama Wildlife Federation, Alabama Division of Wildlife Freshwater Fisheries. And I think with Alabama Division of Wildlife Freshwater Fisheries, there's supposed to be some in each district office, I believe. Okay.
So for us down here, on the causeway.
Yeah. So do they cost?
No, it's a free publication.
Okay.
All the funding came through the grants that I got from the Alabama chapter of the National Wild Turkey Federation and the Alabama Wildlife Federation.
Okay, well, that's super.
But the digital version is available where? Somebody listening to us right now says, okay, I got to get this. It's when we're due for my afternoon. Read this.
If they do social media, it is shown on... If they follow Alabama Black Belt Adventures, it's there. NWTF Alabama, the link is there as well. Those are two that I can think of right offhand.
And if it's okay with you, if somebody wants to send me a note, I can send them a link as well.
Absolutely.
And so I like that glass half full that we talked about going forward. And I do think there are more people, it's anecdotally, my friend group that are engaged in. Not just because all three of us in this room like to hunt a turkey.
Absolutely.
I mean, and that's the beauty, I think, of getting people to come out to a turkey banquet or to do management is because we are motivated because we like to hunt a turkey. And to hunt, but as I've grown older too, I want to hunt a turkey this year and I want there to be turkeys when I'm in the dirt. You know what I'm saying? I want generations of future to be hunting turkeys. So I think there's a lot of folks like that in the turkey world. So hopefully we are on this. Filling up the glass, and we could change things.
I think we are. I think there's a lot more folks out there interested, and it's really not just turkeys, but you know, quail, deer, other game and non-game species. That there's folks are more educated about it now. There's more information readily available.
Right.
I mean, there's a lot of information out there now about managing habitats for wild turkeys. This is just a different approach. From the eco-region angle.
I love it, because it's not just, I mean, you can say things at a introductory level that apply maybe wherever there's a dang wild turkey, right?
Yes.
But you not only get into Alabama, you get into the different zones in Alabama. Like somebody who's not from here thinks Alabama all looks the same way. All of us from here that hunt here go, well, are they in the swamp? Are they up in the hill? You know, are they in the mountains and the hills? Are they in the Black Belt? Are they in the Pine Belt? I mean, it's all different places.
There's quite a bit of differences among the ecoregions. You know, if you're comparing the southwestern Appalachians to the coastal plains down here, and you got the mountains.
Same state, but man, it's
same
different.
Same states and different approaches for management applications. I mean, all these management applications of thinning and burning, wildlife openings, managing for brood habitat, roost sites. I mean, you can do that in every ecoregion. It's just different approaches. Some differences are significant, some are very subtle.
Okay, well, and here's a put you on the spot question. With looking at all these different regions, who's got it easiest? Who has the easiest, lightest lift to get their habitat? What part of the state?
Well, if that correlates to what part of the state probably has the best turkey numbers based on our observations and brood surveys and probably game check, would be the southwestern Appalachians.
I figured you'd go there. I mean, we can look at these maps like you had out before, the densities.
Where is that at exactly?
At North Alabama.
Yeah, northeast Alabama, that chain of the Appalachians that sort of terminates in Alabama, you know, like the Talladega National Forest.
There's no such thing as that. There's no turkeys there.
Okay, let me take that back, Mike. There's no turkeys up there. So.
You know, turkey hunters are liars.
I'd a lot rather hunt around here where we have like flat ground.
Right. Well,
way.
I tell you what, I spent a lot of time with those mountain hunting turkeys when I was at school. Yeah. It's a beautiful place to hunt a turkey, too. But yeah, I figured you might say that. Well, it's like they seem to, it's easier there maybe to have turkey numbers.
I'm not sure if it's easier. It's just that those habitats, there's still like a lot of mass-producing large scopes of oaks in those mountains somewhat. You know, there may not be a lot of – in some of those mountains, there's not a lot of prescribed fire going on.
Right.
The timber composition is mostly hardwood, but yet the turkeys are doing well in a lot of those landscapes. Now, if you want to compare that, let's say down here in southwest Alabama – I mean, this used to be the stronghold.
Yeah, it's where y'all were trapping from.
Yeah, we were trapping from. And I think it's back in the day, you know, with the Alabama and Tombigbee Rivers provided protection to some extent. Back in the late 1800s, early 1900s, when turkey numbers were being decimated, those river swamps provided somewhat inaccessible places for turkeys to live. Where they weren't getting killed.
Yeah.
So that back in the day, and still to a lot of extent, it's still this part of the state is good. Now, I think an area of the state that's struggling based on the habitat is extreme northwest Alabama. There's a lot of habitat fragmentation, big ag, and there may be just small parcels of woodlots and big ag around it. And turkeys, based on our brood surveys and other observations, are just, you know, it's not as good of a stronghold up there. And I talk about what landowners were, so I suggest what landowners could do to maybe help that along in that part of the state.
That's what's so
cool about this. The interior plateau.
Yeah, that's what's so cool about this book is it's very specific to the areas of the state. So once again, you pick up online right now. If you go to Alabama Black Belt Adventures,
yes,
you can get a link there.
Yes.
Yes, I've signed myself up for this. If y'all will send me an email, not a text line, send an email to Sean, S-E-A-N, at fmtalk1065.com. I'll get y'all a link as well. And then your district offices should have a copy of this book as well.
Yeah.
Good stuff. And good to see you. And
good to see y'all.
And if we don't talk to you before, have a great turkey season.
You too.
Thank you, Steve.
Thanks.